What if I told you that a company with $10 million in assets, booming sales, and like a warehouse, just totally packed to the ceiling with premium inventory?
Just a great-looking company on paper.
Right, exactly. What if I told you they could be forced into bankruptcy by like next Tuesday?
It sounds totally counterintuitive.
It really does. I mean, you look at their balance sheet and they look rich,
Yeah?
but then you look at their bank account and they are completely dead in the water.
Which happens all the time.
Right. So before we jump into the actual mechanics of exactly how that happens and how investment bankers can kind of spot it before anyone else does, I should mention this deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel.
Yeah, they're great.
They really are. They've got a full Series 79 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing.
Which is super important for this exam.
Definitely. You can check it out at certfuel.com. So anyway, today we are tackling analysis and evaluation of data.
Yeah, function one.
And listen, the stakes here are just massive. I mean, this specific material makes up 49% of the exam.
It's huge.
That's 37 out of 75 scored questions.
Yeah.
So you are just not going to pass if you try to rote memorize your way through this. You really have to understand the underlying logic.
Right, you just cannot fake your way through this section. I mean, it is the beating heart of what an investment banker actually does day to day.
Yeah.
You know, you have to know how to tear a company apart financially and then put it back together.
But we also know that dry textbook lectures just don't stick. Like staring at a wall of financial formulas is a great way to fall asleep,
Oh, yeah. Oh.
not a great way to actually pass an exam.
Yeah.
So today we're giving these concepts a pulse.
I like that.
We're going to use some pretty absurd scenarios and a few recurring characters to really lock these rules into your brain.
Because a little narrative context goes a long, long way when you're trying to remember the difference between a Schedule 13D and a 14D9.
Under the pressure of a ticking clock,
For a
right?
sec.
So, listener, let me introduce you to our cast for today's deep dive. First up, we have Frank, the founder.
Good old Frank.
Right. So, Frank makes premium stainless steel, Bluetooth enabled smart toasters,
As one does.
naturally. And Frank hates taxes. He eventually wants to take his company public so he can buy a yacht. But he is absolutely terrified of losing control of his toaster empire.
Which is just a classic paranoid founder. I mean, I've met a dozen Franks in real life.
Oh, for sure. Next, we have Debt Heavy Dave.
Dave is a mess.
Dave is a total mess. He runs a competing appliance company, but Jade is addicted to leverage. Like, he is always borrowing money to cover up his operational mistakes.
Yeah, he has terrible liquidity.
Right. He is sweating through his suit as we speak, and he is basically just a walking financial red flag.
And we are definitely going to see exactly how those red flags show up in his financial statements later.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And finally, we have Aggressive Alice.
Okay, Alice.
She is a portfolio manager at a massive hedge fund. She thrives on high growth, high volatility, and taking huge calculated swings.
She wants explosive returns or like nothing at all.
Exactly. The total adrenaline junkie investor. So, where do we actually start with all this?
Well, I think we start by setting the stage for the bankers, because before Frank the founder can sell his toaster company to Alice,
Right.
or before debt-heavy Dave can walk into a bank and just beg for a bridge loan, the bankers need to know what they're actually looking at.
Yeah, how do we even begin to evaluate these wildly different companies?
We do it by looking through three adjusting the focal length on a camera lens. If you just stare at a spreadsheet in a vacuum, you have zero context.
That makes sense.
So the first lens is individual company analysis. This is Frank staring in the mirror.
Just looking at himself.
Exactly. We are looking at his company as a standalone entity. We're pulling his 10K annual reports, his 10Q quarterly reports.
All the SEC filings.
Right.
Right.
And we are digging for his standalone free cash flow and his internal growth rates. But I mean, Frank's internal numbers really only tell us so much, right? Like, if Frank says his toaster margins are amazing, I always have to ask, amazing compared to what?
Which is the perfect segue to the second lens, comparable company analysis.
Or what the industry calls trading comps.
Yes, trading comps. This is Frank looking at his neighbors.
Okay, from the mirror to the neighbors.
Right. We step out of Frank's standalone numbers and we look at the live market multiples of publicly traded companies that do exactly what Frank does.
So other premium appliance makers.
Exactly. We look at things like What is the enterprise value to EBITDA ratio for those competitors?
Like, what is the open market actually willing to pay for a business like this right now?
Right, because the market dictates the reality.
So we have the mirror, then the neighbors. I imagine the third lens just kind of zooms out to the entire city.
That's a really great way to visualize it.
Yeah.
The third lens is industry sector analysis.
Okay.
This is evaluating the whole neighborhood's ecosystem. Like, is the premium appliance sector actually growing, or are people just eating less toast?
Right. Are carbs out this year?
Exactly. Or are supply chain costs crushing profit margins across the board? Is there a massive wave of M&A happening?
Mergers and acquisitions.
Right. You have to frame whether Frank is the leader of a booming pack or if he's just, you know, the best house in a deteriorating neighborhood.
That makes a ton of sense. But to even start with that first lens, you know, staring in the mirror, we need the actual numbers.
We need the data.
Which brings us to the holy trinity of financial statements. And listener, every valuation you will ever build in your career rests on these three pillars.
The balance sheet, the income statement, and the cash flow statement.
Yeah, you really have to understand how they interact.
You do.
So let's break them down mechanically. The balance sheet is basically a photograph. It's a snapshot frozen in time at midnight on the last day of the quarter.
It tells you exactly what Frank owns and exactly what he owes at that exact second.
Right. And the fundamental identity here, and listener, never forget this, is assets equal liabilities plus stockholders' equity.
It must always balance. That's why it's called a balance sheet.
Yeah, if it doesn't balance, you messed up.
Big time. Then you move to the income statement. If the balance sheet is a photograph, the income statement is more like a video recording.
It tracks the flow over time.
Yeah, usually a full quarter or a full year, and it operates like a waterfall.
Right, so revenue flows in at the very top, and as that water falls down the statement, costs get subtracted in very distinct layers.
You subtract the cost of raw materials.
Then operating expenses.
Then interest.
Then taxes, until whatever trickles out at the very bottom is your net income.
And that trickle at the bottom connects us to the third statement. The cash flow statement is kind of the ultimate explainer.
Because of accounting rules, right? Yep. Net income does not equal the actual cash sitting in your bank account.
Exactly. The cash flow statement bridges that gap. It shows exactly how your cash balance changed from, say, January 1st to December 31st.
And it's divided clearly into operating, investing, and financing activities. All right, listener, I want you to think fast here. I'm going to ask you a direct question about how this plumbing connects.
This is a great test.
Okay. Net income flows from the bottom of the income statement into two EO other specific places in a financial model. Where does it go?
Yeah, take a second to think about that. Where does it go?
Got it.
It's the starting point for operating cash flow at the very top of the cash flow statement.
Yep.
And it flows into retained earnings over in the stockholders' equity section of the balance sheet.
Exactly. If your model doesn't tie back to all three of those places, your balance sheet won't balance, and you've made a mistake.
You'll be chasing that error for hours.
Oh, the worst. Now, while we're looking at that income statement waterfall, there is a massive exam trap we need to call out right now.
Yes.
It is the line item for depreciation and amortization, or D&A.
The exam writers absolutely love testing this because it trips up junior bankers constantly.
It's so tricky.
It is, because D&A is a non-cash expense. Think about Frank's toaster factory. Over time, his assembly line machinery gets old and wears down.
Right. Machines break.
Yeah. So the accounting rules let him record that wear and tear as a depreciation expense on his income statement.
Which is fantastic for Frank. I mean, it reduces his reported net income on paper, which means he pays less in taxes.
Everyone loves lower taxes.
But here's the critical part, listener. Frank didn't actually write a check to a guy named Depreciation.
No.
Like, no cash left the building.
Exactly. It does not touch his actual bank account. But because it artificially reduced his net income, when we carry that net income over to start the cash flow statement,
we're starting with an artificially low number.
Right. So we have to fix it.
Yeah.
We take that reduced net income and we add the non-cash D&A right back to find out how much real hard cash Frank actually generated from his operation.
It's just an accounting fiction. So listener, if you see D&A on the exam, your brain should immediately think, add it back to cash flow.
Always add it back.
All right, so we have our three statements. Let's bring Dead Heavy Dave back into the room.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, Dave's appliance company is struggling. He comes to you, the banker, and says, hey, look at my balance sheet. I have $10 million in assets and only $5 million in short-term debt. I am incredibly wealthy.
but you see him sweating through his shirt.
Exactly. You need to know if Dave is actually solvent today.
This is where we measure liquidity, because assets on a piece of paper don't pay the electricity bill.
No, they do not.
The most basic metric here is the current ratio, which is just current assets divided by current liabilities.
Okay, so since Dave has $10 million in current assets and $5 million in current liabilities, his current ratio is 2.0.
Right. In theory, he has twice as much short-term value as he has short-term debt.
In theory. But Dave is a mess. We cannot trust a simple ratio with this guy. We need to stress test him.
We had the acid test,
which the exam usually called the quick ratio. It is the exact same formula, but we forcefully subtract inventory from his current assets before we divide.
And we do that because inventory is the most toxic, illiquid current asset a company can hold during a cash crunch.
Listener, just imagine your landlord bangs on your door and demands your rent by tomorrow morning. You cannot pay him in 500 unsold smart toasters.
They won't take them.
You just can't do it. Inventory might not sell. Or, like, if you're desperate for cash, you might have to liquidate it to a liquidator for pennies on the dollar.
That is the harsh reality of distress. The quick ratio essentially pretends that inventory is completely worthless.
It just wipes it out.
Yeah, it asks, if your inventory never sells, can you still pay your debts?
And this leads directly to a major exam trap. Listener, the gap between the current ratio and the quick ratio is the inventory.
Yes.
The exam will test this conceptually. The quick ratio bites inventory-heavy or distressed manufacturing companies the absolute hardest.
So if Dave has a current ratio of 2.0, but a quick ratio of, say, 0.5, it means his warehouse is full of junk. He can't move, he has no actual cash, and he is going to default on his loans next week.
That is the exact scenario I described in the intro of this deep dive. The balance sheet looks totally fine until you realize it's entirely tied up in unsold toasters.
Yep, it's a mirage.
So Dave's a disaster. And Frank senses blood in the water. Frank thinks, you know, maybe I should buy Dave out.
Classic Frank.
But before Frank can go to the market to raise money for an acquisition, we need to prove that Frank's own company is actually making money.
Right, so we move from liquidity to profitability.
And this brings us to the earnings layers.
Yeah.
Okay, let's unpack this. The holy trinity of profitability metrics. EBIT, EBITDA, and EBITDAR.
Let's strip these down one by one. EBIT is earnings before interest and taxes.
Right.
This is your pure operating income. It shows how much money the toaster business makes before the government takes a cut and before the banks take a cut.
Next is EBITDA, which adds back that depreciation and amortization we just spent time dissecting.
Exactly. This is the ultimate workhorse multiple of investment banking.
It really is.
It gives you a clean, unvarnished look at the profitability of the core operations, completely stripping out the capital structure choices of the founders.
Because whether Frank financed his factory with debt or equity,
right?
I mean, that shouldn't change our view of how good he is at actually selling toasters.
Right. Operations are operations.
But then we have this weird outlier, EBITDAR, with an R at the end.
Yeah, that R stands for rent, or sometimes restructuring.
But why does rent get its own special acronym? Like, why do we care so much about rent that we carve it out of EBITDA?
Well, think about the airline industry or massive retail chains or hotels.
Okay, hotels.
You might have one hotel chain that physically owns all of its real estate. Because they own the buildings, they have huge non-cash depreciation expenses,
which get it added back to EBITDA.
Right, making their EBITDA look massive.
Yeah, they look super profitable.
But imagine a competing hotel chain that chose to lease all of its buildings instead. They don't own the property, so they have zero depreciation.
Oh, but they have massive monthly cash rent expenses.
Exactly. If you simply compare the EBITDA of both companies, the chain that leases looks incredibly weak and unprofitable, simply because rent reduces EBITDA while depreciation does not.
Oh, I see. It's a total apples to oranges comparison. The underlying hotel operations, like renting out rooms, could be identical, but the real estate strategy totally skews the math.
Yes. So adding the rent back in using EBITDAR normalizes the playing field.
That is fascinating. It lets a banker compare a leased asset operator directly against an owned asset operator without the real estate strategy muddying the waters.
Spot on. But we really need to highlight another massive exam trap regarding EBITDA.
Let's hear it.
The exam writers will aggressively try to trick you into treating EBITDA as if it is a proxy for free cash flow.
Oh, they do this all the time.
It is absolutely not cash flow. Never confuse the two.
So why isn't it?
Because EBITDA ignores three massive cash drains. First, it ignores working capital changes, like when Frank has to tie up millions of dollars buying raw metal.
That's real cash going out the door.
Right. Second, it ignores capital expenditures, or CapEx. That's the hard cash Frank spends replacing broken machinery.
Also real cash.
And third, it completely ignores the interest and taxes Frank actually has to pay to the bank and the IRS.
Right. So a company can have $50 million in EBITDA and literally zero free cash flow. Listener, do not fall for that on the test.
It's a classic trap. Now, speaking of Frank buying raw metal, that brings us to one of the most heavily tested and, frankly, most misunderstood concepts on the Series 79.
Oh, yeah.
Inventory valuation methods.
LIFO versus FIFO. First in, first out, or last in, first out.
Let's make this incredibly concrete.
Okay, so Frank makes toasters out of stainless steel. But let's say we are in a period of high inflation.
Which happens.
Right. The cost of raw steel is skyrocketing. In January, steel costs him $10 a sheet. But by December, that exact same steel costs him $20 a sheet.
Okay, so when Frank sells a finished toaster in December, the IRS makes him decide which cost to apply to that sale to figure out his profit.
And that cost is called COGS, right? Cost of goods sold.
Exactly. So if he uses FIFO first in, first out, he reaches back to January and uses that old, cheap $10 cost.
Because the first material that came into the warehouse is the first cost to go out onto the income statement.
Correct. And during inflation, pulling old, cheap costs means his COGS is very low.
And mathematically, if his costs are low, his reported profit looks incredibly high.
And investors love high profit.
They do. But wait. Frank hates taxes.
Yeah.
We established this. Higher reported profit means a higher tax bill.
He is not going to like that at all, which is why Frank is going to look at the alternative, LIFO. Last in, first out.
Okay.
Under LIFO, when Frank sells that toaster in December, he pulls the newest, most expensive $20 cost to calculate his COGS.
Because the last material in is the first cost out, so his costs are much higher.
Yes.
Which crushes his reported profit.
Exactly. And a crushed, lower reported profit means he pays significantly lower income taxes to the IRS.
Okay, so listener direct question time. Think about the scenario we just built.
Yeah. Put yourself in Frank's shoes.
We are in a period of aggressive inflation. Frank is a founder who despises paying taxes. Which inventory method is he instructing his accountants to use?
Take a beat.
Got your answer.
He is absolutely choosing LIFO.
100%.
In an inflationary environment, LIFO maximizes your cost of goods sold, which minimizes your earnings, which minimizes your tax bill.
It is purely a tax deferral strategy.
Fundamentally, yes. It keeps cash in Frank's pocket.
But this creates a massive headache for us as bankers. Like, if Frank is using LIFO to dodge taxes, his earnings look terrible.
Yeah, they look artificially bad.
Right. But debt-heavy Dave might be using FIFO to artificially inflate his earnings so he can trick the bank into giving him a loan. How do we compare them?
The great equalizer here is called the LIFO reserve.
Okay, tell us about the reserve.
The LIFO reserve is a required disclosure in the footnotes. It is the mathematical difference between what Frank's inventory is valued at under his current LIFO method versus what it would be valued at if he had used FIFO instead.
So it's the gap between the two.
Exactly. Bankers simply take the LIFO reserve, add it back to Frank's balance sheet, adjust his taxes, and boom, Frank is normalized.
Oh, that's elegant. We can now compare him directly to Dave.
Yes. And here is the exam trap.
Listen up.
The formula for calculating the LIFO reserve is strictly FIFO minus LIFO. Always FIFO minus LIFO.
Never the reverse.
Never. If you flip that subtraction on test day, you will choose the trap answer.
FIFO minus LIFO. Burn that into your brain. Okay, so we've analyzed Frank's profitability. Thanks to LIFO, he's keeping his taxes down. His cash flow is strong.
He's doing great.
Now he is ready to buy Dave's failing company. But he needs to borrow money to do it. We have to look at leverage.
Leverage, the great amplifier of risk and reward.
How much debt can Frank's toaster empire actually shoulder before it collapses? We measure this capacity with the interest coverage ratio.
The standard formula for the interest coverage ratio is EBIT divided by interest expense.
Right.
It tells a banker exactly how many times over Frank's core operating profit can pay his annual interest bill.
Okay, hold on. Let me play devil's advocate here. I want to push back on this formula.
Go for it.
Why are we using EBIT in the numerator? Like, why wouldn't we just use net income? Isn't net income the bottom line, undeniable truth of what a company made?
It's a really common trap to think that way, but think about the chronological flow of that income statement waterfall we talked about earlier.
Good.
Net income is at the very bottom. It has already had the interest expense subtracted out of it.
Oh, right. I completely forgot.
If you use net income to calculate if you can afford your interest payments, you are completely and artificially understating your coverage.
Because you'd be testing your ability to pay a bill using money that has already paid that exact bill.
Exactly. EBIT shows the pool of profit available before the bank takes its cut.
That makes perfect sense. Always look at the money before the debt service.
Okay, what about measuring the absolute size of the debt mountain?
For that, we use the ratio of net debt to EBITDA.
But what exactly is net debt?
Net debt is total debt minus cash and cash equivalents, which is incredibly logical when you think about it. If debt-heavy Dave owes the bank $10 million, but he miraculously has $3 million in cash sitting in a checking account.
Realistically, his true debt burden is only $7
million. Right. He could wire that $3 million to the bank right now to pay down the principal.
Precisely. And understanding that subtraction leads us directly into the most critical concept in M&A. Valuation, specifically calculating enterprise value, or EV.
This is the big one.
This is the standard metric used to determine purchase prices in mergers and acquisitions.
So what does Frank's whole enterprise actually cost to acquire? The formula is market cap plus total debt plus preferred stock plus minority interest, minus cash and equivalents.
That's a mouthful. To make this stick, let's use a real-world analogy. Calculating enterprise value is exactly like buying a house.
Ooh, I like this. Listener, picture this. You are buying a beautiful new house. The market cap of a company is basically the equity of the house.
Right. It is the cash you hand over to the seller for the keys.
But if that house has a massive mortgage attached to it, and as the new owner, you are legally assuming that mortgage, you are effectively paying for that too.
You're taking on that liability.
So you must add the debt to your purchase price.
Right. You are buying the entire capital structure of the house, equity and debt combined.
But imagine you unlock the front door, you walk into the kitchen, and you find a giant duffel bag filled with $2 million in cold, hard cash sitting on the kitchen island.
Best open house ever.
Right. As the new owner of the house, you get to keep it. That cash fundamentally lowers your effective purchase price.
It offsets what you paid.
So you subtract that cash from the total.
And that's exactly why we subtract cash in the EV formula.
Wow.
An acquirer buying Frank's company can take Frank's balance sheet cash and immediately use it to pay down the debt they just assumed.
But beware the exam trap here, listener. Enterprise value represents the whole capital structure. We just established that the term net debt already has the cash subtracted out of it.
Yes, do not forget that.
So if a test question gives you the market cap and the net debt, do not subtract the cash a second time. You'll be double counting the duffel bag and you will get the math totally wrong.
They love trying to get you to double subtract cash. Don't do it. Now, what's fascinating here is how enterprise value feeds into intrinsic valuation.
Okay, where are we going with this?
If we want to know what Frank's company is inherently worth based on its ability to generate future cash, we don't look at comps. We build a discounted cash flow model, or DCF.
Ah, the dreaded DCF.
I know, it's mathematically intense, but conceptually it's simple. We project Frank's cash flows 5 or 10 years into the future, and we discount those future dollars back to what they are worth in today's present value.
Because a dollar today is worth more than a dollar 10 years from now.
Time value of money.
Right. And the specific discount rate we use to bring those future numbers back to the present is WACC. The weighted average cost of capital.
Exactly. This rate represents exactly what it costs Frank to fund his business, blending his cost of debt and his cost of equity.
But there is a massive exam trap hiding inside the WACC formula. It is the tax shield.
The infamous one minus the corporate tax rate adjustment.
Yes. The exam will try to trick you into applying that tax shield to the cost of equity. Listener, you never apply the tax shield to equity. It only applies to the cost of debt.
And let's focus on the why here. Why do we shield debt but not equity? It's not just an arbitrary rule.
No, it's because of the IRS tax code. Interest payments on corporate debt are legally tax-deductible expenses.
Right. By allowing that deduction, the government is effectively subsidizing a portion of your debt.
So your true after-tax cost of debt is actually lower than the interest rate the bank charges you.
But if Frank pays out a dividend to his equity shareholders, the IRS doesn't care.
Not at all.
Dividends are not tax-deductible. The government offers no subsidy for equity. Therefore, mathematically, there is no tax shield on equity in the WACC formula.
Brilliant. Now let's bring the narrative forward a bit. Frank has his WACC, his DCF looks spectacular, and his enterprise value is sky high.
He is feeling powerful.
He decides it is finally time to acquire debt-heavy Gabe's company. But Frank doesn't want to use his own cash. He wants to buy Gabe using Frank's toaster company stock.
Which introduces accretion-dilution deal math.
The moment Frank proposes an all-stock deal, his board of directors is going to ask one specific question. Will printing new shares to buy Dave's company increase our earnings per share, which is accretive, or will it decrease our earnings per share, which is dilutive?
And there is a golden rule here for all stock transactions. If you remember this exam trap, you can solve these questions in 10 seconds without doing complex math.
Give us the rule. I love a shortcut.
In a 100% stock-funded deal, the transaction is accretive if the target's price-to-earnings ratio, their PE, is lower than the acquirer's PE.
Let's logic that out. Let's say Frank's incredibly successful stock trades at a massive PE of 20.
Okay.
But Dave's distressed, failing stock trades at a sad PE of 5.
Right.
Frank is taking his highly valued, incredibly expensive currency, and he is using it to buy Dave's relatively cheap earnings.
Yes.
Frank is acquiring vastly more earnings per share from Dave than he is giving up by printing the new stock.
He is literally buying earnings on the cheap. If your PE as the acquirer is higher than your target's PE, the deal is accretive.
And if your PE is lower?
You are destroying value and diluting your existing shareholders. It's really that simple.
Okay, so Frank does the math and realizes a deal for Dave right now is just too risky.
Dave's operations are way too messy.
Yeah. So Frank decides to pause the M&A strategy and instead focus on raising more capital privately to scale up his own empire before an eventual IPO.
But this opens up a whole new can of regulatory worms.
It does. What legal structure does Frank actually need to be in to take institutional money?
Well, let's evaluate his organizational structures. The vast majority of major public companies are C-Corp.
They are the standard.
They are. They allow an unlimited number of shareholders, and they can issue multiple classes of stock. But they suffer from the dreaded double taxation.
Right. The company itself pays a corporate income tax on its profits. And then when it distributes whatever is left to the shareholders as a dividend, the shareholders pay personal taxes on that exact same money.
Exactly. The money is taxed twice.
Well, Frank hates taxes. We established this early on. So Frank goes to his corporate lawyers and says, make me an S-Corp instead.
Because S-Corp have passed through taxation.
Right. The company itself pays zero federal income tax. All the profits just pass through directly to the owner's personal tax returns. It's a massive tax shield.
And his lawyers will tell him it's completely impossible if he wants to eventually go public and scale globally.
Why?
The SEC and the IRS know that pass-through taxation is a massive benefit, so they tightly restrict who gets to use it. They don't want massive public giants dodging corporate taxes.
So what are the actual limitations of an S-Corp?
They are severe. First, an S-Corp is strictly capped at 100 shareholders.
Which instantly kills any dream of an IPO.
Completely. Furthermore, you can only have one single class of common stock, no preferred shares for fancy venture capitalists.
That hurts.
And critically, you cannot have any non-resident alien shareholders. Every single owner must be a U.S. citizen or resident.
Oh, wow. So Frank absolutely cannot build a global publicly traded empire under an S-Corp structure.
He just can't.
Well, what if he tries to classify as a REIT, a real estate investment trust? Mm-hmm. They have pass-through taxation. They don't pay corporate tax.
Frank makes smart toasters, not shopping malls.
Fair point.
To qualify as a REIT, your assets and income must be overwhelmingly focused on real estate. And even if you magically qualify to keep that tax-free status, you are legally required to distribute at least 90% of your taxable income to your shareholders every single year.
So you can't retain earnings to build new toaster factories.
Nope.
Okay, so C Corp it is. Frank accepts his fate. Now he wants to raise private capital from heavy-hitting institutional investors before his IPO. Who is he allowed to target?
We have two major regulatory categories of lead investors here, and this is a massive exam trap.
Do not mix these two definitions up, listener. We have QIBs and we have qualified purchasers.
Let's draw a hard, bright line between them because they unlock completely different regulatory exemptions.
Okay, let's start with QIBs.
A QIB is a qualified institutional buyer. To be a QIB, an institution must own and invest on a discretionary basis at least $100 million in securities.
The only exception is if it's a broker-dealer acting for their own account.
Yeah.
Right. Then the threshold drops to $10
million. Correct. But generally, think $100 million.
And what does being a QIB unlock?
It unlocks the ability to participate in Rule 144A private resales.
Okay, 144A.
Rule 144A allows restricted, unregistered stock to be traded freely among QIB.
Okay, so 100 million for a QIB unlocks 144A. What about a qualified purchaser?
A qualified purchaser is defined by a much lower dollar threshold. It is $5 million in investments for an individual person or $25 million in investments for an institution.
And what exemption does that key unlock?
It unlocks Section 3C7 private funds. These are hyper-exclusive hedge funds or private equity funds that don't want to register as investment companies.
So, listener, memorize this mapping. QIB is 100 million for 144A. Qualified purchaser is 5 million or 25 million for 3C7 funds.
They're different thresholds for completely different rules. Don't swap them.
All right. So Frank and his bankers build their target list. They're looking for investors and they come across Aggressive Alice.
Oh, Alice is back.
Remember Alice. She runs a 3C7 fund with an aggressive growth investment mandate. What does Alice actually want?
She wants maximum capital appreciation. She wants companies with explosive revenue growth, and she is perfectly willing to accept high risk and wild volatility to get it.
So she buys early stage tech, unproven biotech, and disruptive startups.
Exactly.
So let's say Frank gets cold feet. He decides to pivot. He stops trying to innovate smart toasters and turns his company into a stable, slow-growth, high-dividend-paying appliance utility.
Just a boring, cash-flowing business.
Right. Should his bankers pitch Aggressive Alice on participating in a follow-on equity offering?
Absolutely not. As a banker, you have a regulatory duty to match the specific security to the investor's stated strategy.
It's a suitability thing.
Yes. A slow-growth, high-dividend stock targets income funds or value income funds. If you pitch a boring dividend yield to Alice, who mandates exclusive capital appreciation, the deal will fail and compliance will flag you.
Okay, let's throw a wrench into the narrative. What if Frank changes his mind again?
He's very indecisive today.
Very. He announces to the public that he is going to acquire debt-heavy Dave's company. It's front page news. Suddenly, risk arbitrage funds start heavily trading both of their stocks.
Oh, this is a great test scenario.
Listener, direct question. If Frank announces he is buying Dave, what exact positions is a risk arb fund taking in the market?
Think about who they are betting on and who they are betting against.
Got an idea.
A risk arbitrage fund will immediately go long the target and short the acquirer.
So they're going to buy Dave stock and they will short sell Frank stock.
Exactly.
Explain the logic behind that. Why short the successful guy buying the failing guy?
Because of how the market predictably reacts to M&A announcements. When a deal is announced, the target company stock usually jumps up to sit just slightly below the actual offer price.
Right, because they are getting bought out at a premium.
But the acquiring company stock usually drops because investors worry about the massive debt Frank is taking on and the huge integration risks of merging the companies.
So the risk arb fund, which the exam might also refer to as merger arb, is betting strictly on the deal closing.
Exactly. They do not care about toasters. They do not care about Dave or Frank's fundamentals at all.
They are just playing the math.
They are simply trying to capture the tiny mathematical spread between Dave's current stock price and the final buyout price. It is a pure binary math bet on the transaction successfully closing without any regulatory interference.
That makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
We're moving into the final act here. Frank completes his IPO.
He finally made it.
He is now a massive, publicly traded C Corp. He's rich. He has his yacht.
Good for Frank.
But being public means anyone can buy your stock. And his massive cash flows have attracted sharks.
Oh.
A hostile corporate raider decides they want to forcefully take over Frank's toaster empire, fire Frank, and sell off the parts.
This is a founder's absolute worst nightmare.
But before Frank and his board can mount a defense, they need to know who is actually holding their stock right now. The bankers have to urgently pull the ownership filings.
Let's break down the big three filings that tell the story of who owns a public company. Schedule 13D, Schedule 13G, and Form 13F.
Okay, let's start with 13D.
Schedule 13D is the terrifying one. This is filed by active investors who acquire more than 5% of the company's voting stock and explicitly intend to influence or take control of the company.
Think of aggressive activist hedge funds like Elliott Management or Carl Icahn.
Right. And critically, they must file this within 5 days of crossing that 5% threshold.
5 days. The SEC wants the market to know immediately when a shark takes a bite. So 5 days for 13D.
Yeah.
But what if it's not a shark?
What do you mean?
What if it's like Vanguard, or BlackRock, or a sleepy index fund that accidentally bought 5% just to balance their portfolio? Yeah. Do they have to file the scary form?
No, and that's the key distinction. Passive investors file a Schedule 13G. It is essentially the we come in peace filing.
We come in peace. I love that.
It signals to the market, hey, we own a huge chunk of your stock, but we have absolutely no intention of telling Frank how to run his toaster business.
And Form 13F.
13F is a quarterly filing made by massive institutional investment managers, specifically those managing over $100 million in qualifying assets.
Okay, so it's a broad disclosure.
It is basically a quarterly disclosure of their entire long equity portfolio. It lets the market track what the whales are buying and selling.
If you think about it, these filings dictate the exact psychological state of Frank's boardroom.
Totally.
Like, if the bankers pull the data and see a swarm of aggressive 13D filings from activist funds, the board knows a hostile takeover is imminent and they have to fight for their lives.
But if they mostly see 13G filings from index funds, they can breathe a little easier. The ownership data literally drives the M&A response.
And in our scenario, it's a shark. The hostile bidder officially bypasses Frank's board and launches a tender offer directly to Frank's shareholders.
Bold move.
They offer to buy the public shares at a massive premium to the current market price, trying to seduce the shareholders into selling out.
And Frank's board cannot just sit in a conference room and ignore this. Under SEC rules, the target board has a fiduciary duty to officially respond to a tender offer.
They cannot stay silent.
No. They must state their official position on the offer within exactly 10 business days of the tender offer officially commencing.
Why exactly 10 days? Like, what's the rush?
Because retail shareholders are panicking. The stock is highly volatile, and investors need official, reasoned guidance from the board before they make a rash decision to tender their shares.
So the SEC forces their hand.
Right. The SEC gives the board 10 days to evaluate the offer and respond publicly.
And they file this response on a specific form, right?
Yeah.
Schedule 14D to 9.
Yes. 14D to 9.
And they essentially have four legal options for their response. Correct. Mm-hmm. They can recommend that shareholders accept the offer. They can forcefully recommend rejection. They can state they are remaining neutral. Or what is the weird fourth option?
They can state they are fundamentally unable to take a position at this time.
Which feels like a cop-out.
It does, but if they choose this, they have to explicitly explain why. Usually it involves citing a lack of information from the bidder or needing more time to secure an independent fairness opinion.
But no matter what, they must file that 14D9 within 10 business days.
Yes.
So Frank is panicking. The hostile bid is live. The board is drafting their 14D9 to reject it. Mm. And Frank calls his bankers and says, forget the lawyers. We have millions in cash from our LIFO strategy. I'm just going to authorize the company to aggressively buy our own shares in the open market right now. We will drive the stock price so high the bidder won't be able to afford it.
And this is where the banker has to step in and save Frank from committing a federal crime.
Literally a crime.
This brings up a massive exam trap, the issuer purchase restriction.
Explain the restriction, because Frank's idea actually sounds like a great defense mechanism.
It sounds great, but it is market manipulation. Under the issuer purchase restriction rules, if a third party has launched an active tender offer for Frank's company, Frank is strictly prohibited from buying his own shares in the open market outside of the disclosed tender process.
The SEC basically puts the target company in a penalty box to ensure a fair fight.
Exactly. Frank cannot quietly hoover up shares to manipulate the price and tilt the playing field.
He has to fight the battle transparently. But what if Frank decides on a completely different nuclear option?
What's he thinking now?
What if he says, you know what? I am sick of Wall Street. I am sick of activist investors. I am going to team up with a private equity firm. We are going to leverage up, buy out all my public shareholders, and I am taking this toaster company private again.
That completely changes the regulatory landscape that triggers the going private regime.
Why is it treated differently?
Because Frank is an insider effectively buying out his own public shareholders, so there is a massive conflict of interest. He naturally wants to pay the lowest price possible, but his fiduciary duty as a director is to get the shareholders the highest price possible.
So the SEC forces him to file a Schedule 13E3.
Yes. This filing is heavily scrutinized and intensely focused on documenting whether the buyout price and the process are actually fair to the unaffiliated public shareholders.
And there is a magic tripwire number that triggers this entire going private disclosure regime.
There is.
Listener, direct question for you. Think hard. What is the exact number of shareholders that triggers this going private rule?
Think about the threshold.
Got it.
the Tripwire is dropping below 300 holders of record.
300.
If Frank's buyout transaction has the reasonable likelihood or the explicit purpose of causing the Equiny class to be held by fewer than 300 holders of record, the going private rules instantly kick in.
That 300 number is critical. The second you drop below it, the SEC steps in with 13E3. Circle that in your notes right now.
We have covered a tremendous amount of ground here today, from the absolute basics of accounting up through the boardroom drama of hostile takeovers.
We really have. We went from the mirror to the neighbors to the neighborhood. So let's lock this material in with a rapid-fire recap of the most testable takeaways.
I'm ready.
I'll tee up the concept. You give the definitive exam answer. Ready?
Fire away.
Dead heavy Dave's liquidity. Current ratio versus quick ratio.
The gap between them is inventory. The quick ratio strips inventory out completely because you cannot pay rent with a warehouse full of unsold posters in a crisis.
Frank faces massive inflation. LIFO versus FIFO inventory methods.
Frank chooses LIFO. It pulls the newest, most expensive costs to his cost of goods sold. That crushes his reported profit, which legally lowers his tax bill. And remember, the LIFO reserve formula is always FIFO minus LIFO.
Valuation rules, enterprise value and WACC.
EV subtracts cash, because an acquirer uses that duffel bag of cash to immediately pay down the debt they assumed. WACC applies the 1 minus tax rate shield only to the cost of debt, because the IRS lets you deduct interest payments, but equity dividends get no tax shield.
Targeting private wealth. QIB versus qualified purchaser.
QIB requires $100 million in discretionary securities and unlocks a 144A restricted trading. Qualified purchaser is $5 million for an individual or $25 million for an institution, and it unlocks Elite 3C 7 private funds.
Finally, the hostile takeover. Target board response and going private.
The target board has exactly 10 business days to file a Schedule 14D9 outlining their official position on a tender offer. And going private via a 13E3 is triggered by any transaction that drops the company below 300 holders of record.
Excellent. So what does this all mean for you as a future investment banker? We've spent all this time diving into these incredibly rigid formulas.
So many formulas.
Right. EBITDA normalization, LIFO reserves, WACC tax shields. When you're studying, it feels like pure hard science.
It does feel like physics. There is a right answer and a wrong answer. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over.
Play it off.
Earlier, we talked about building a DCF, a discounted cash flow model, to find Frank's intrinsic enterprise value. To do that, you are mathematically projecting his cash flows 5, 10, sometimes 20 years into the future.
Which is wild when you really step back and think about it. Like, who on earth knows what a smart toaster will look like in 20 years?
Or what inflation will be.
Or what consumer behavior will dictate.
Exactly. We use these incredibly exacting, precise formulas to build these models. We fight over basis points in the WACC calculation. But despite all that rigorous math we've discussed today, a DCF valuation is ultimately just a deeply mathematical way of quantifying human optimism.
That's deep.
You are putting a rigid, defensible number on a very fragile hope for the future.
A mathematical way of quantifying human optimism. I love that perspective. It reminds you that behind all the SEC forms and coverage ratios, this business is still driven by human behavior.
It always is.
Keep that in mind next time you're staring down a spreadsheet trying to balance a balance sheet. Thanks for going deep with us today on the Series 79 Prep Listener. Keep grinding, trust the logic, and we'll see you next time.